Welcome to the Diary 101 podcast. I am your host, Akakandelo Akandepwe. And yes, it's a new episode. It's a new month. This is my first guest in April. So I'm pretty excited. Again, I'm always excited about something because this is somebody I'm pretty close to. And he's also one of my mentors. I can't wait for everybody to meet my mentors. When it comes to an end, I'll say, oh, Palia, we've reached. That's it. That's all with my mentors. But so this is somebody you want to have a conversation with any day, somebody who will roast you and flex on anything, but somebody who also inspires me to do better and see life in a different light. I feel like he knows the ACA outside university and the ACA in university. So it's really cool to have him on this podcast. So without taking much of my time or his time, hi, Mr. Chisupa, how are you doing?
Oh, hi, Aka. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to be on your podcast. Thank you very much.
So you're Mr. Ngosa Chisupa. I forgot. I was supposed to say, welcome, Mr. Ngosa Chisupa. But I was just like, hi, Mr. Chisupa. Because I was like, how am I supposed to introduce you?
I think it's, it reminds me of a colleague who was in the media industry. And he was being interviewed by the daughter. And, so then she says, so welcome to the program, Alec. Now, Alec is the father to that lady in Zuba. What's her name again? There's that actress in Zuba. Yeah, so her father is Alec Mukala. So she was interviewing, Ponga interviewing the father. Yes, Dennis, so what do you think of the game? So these things happen, So it's okay. I think we are good. Yeah.
And
you can call me Remy. That's fine.
It's going to get more interesting as I interview more people because I'll be having older guests. And because of our culture, I'm like, I really have to call them Mr. I really can't call them their first names because the first three guests, I really was just calling their names. I'm like, oh, hi this, hi that. And now I'm going, it's getting interesting and deep, so I'm like, I don't know how to do this, but I'm enjoying.
When you get Professor Pinalo for again, Vice Chancellor, usually to make it more amenable, you just use semi words like prof. Okay, prof. What do you So prof sounds a little more simple. It's not too heavy, But saying no professor, that might sound a bit too heavy. Yeah.
Thanks for highlighting that. I might just have him soon. I hope he agreed.
Great.
Very busy.
Well, that's fine. I mean, you can always get him through your other mentor who sits next door. So that will be easy.
Well, first, I have to get that other mentor on the podcast. Then maybe I can convince his neighbor to actually agree to be on this. But again, it's always interesting to have conversations with my mentors. Especially you. Surprisingly, the other mentor we're mentioning is the one mentor I established a relationship with formally. It was a whole introduction, what I wanted to do. I guess because it's serious. But with you, it came about because I was your student last year. And I don't know why you liked me, but I was your student. Not your best, thank God. I always say thank God. But not your best. But we started to have our own relationship and sharing opportunities and just having conversations. I started to realize that, so this man actually does know what he's talking about. And he's very experienced. So tell me your experience with different students, including me, over the years.
Well, I think teaching or lecturing at the university obviously comes with a lot of experiences. And also, I think this is why I think it's interesting because, one, you are impacting knowledge to different types of students, there are different types of interests. And teaching a subject like organizational behavior, it's actually a very real subject. I mean, you are dealing with how students will transition one in the workplace or whether they are self-employed? How will they manage emotional intelligence? How will they manage leadership? How will they manage culture? So when you're bringing in real life stories, maybe you say, fine, how did Google manage? How did Microsoft handle it? How did ShopRite handle it? How did apps? So you get a lot of experiences. Yeah. So it's, I think it's quite exciting. And also organizational behavior picks up a bit of the international dimension. And then when we are learning, and in your case, you are someone also who had that global outreach. I mean, you spend some time in the US. Yeah, so at least we could relate. You are somebody who could, one could say, someone who's sort of, I could describe sort of as outgoing. Yeah, so it was easy to relate.
When I talk about my mentors flexing, this is one that always flexes. I was like, I thought you're not going to mention that, but it's all okay. Over the podcast as well. But thanks.
Okay.
I really did struggle with organizational behavior. Like you said, it's really real life. It's something you can relate to. But when you're a student, I thought it was just one more course I had to pass to graduate. Now I'm in the real world. And I'm doing an organization called Transfer Management, and we work with young people to give them more skill sets, exposure, and experience, because it's a gap we've noticed in Zambia. And yesterday I was at UNILAS, and I met my friends, and they were like, oh, like I were all interning and working. So they're like, oh, my, I have never thought about advanced management or the other courses we took. And I was like, well, I use OB every day mm-hmm. of my life. I feel like texting Mr. Chisuba and saying, ooh, I don't know what to do with this because it's a lot going on. So I use every OB every day in my life, and it wasn't my best course. And it's like, how do I navigate that? Like, have you had any of your other students come up and say, how do we now start using OB in our lives? Or do we need to go back to our books and read more?
Well, actually, from what you've actually said, reminds me of one of my students, Caleb Simasiku. He's working in Qatar. So I usually invite him as a guest lecturer in my OB class when he's on holiday, because his family is still here. So one of the things he mentioned was that, look, actually, he was headhunted by Qatar Airlines. And he had five interviews, and one of them was on organizational behavior. So he was my master's student. So you can imagine he could relate with OB. Then I even have students now, you know, after a lecture, they actually come to you and say, you know, sir, what you're actually teaching, this is what I'm going through at work, you know. It's really helping me, you know, or what I'm going through life, you know. I think these principles, I think, will help me make a particular decision. You know, there are some people who don't realize it, you know, emotional intelligence, you know, how do they manage their emotions? There are some who say, I think that's why maybe people talk a lot behind my back at the office. Maybe it's because I'm too harsh. So I think with emotional intelligence, self-awareness, you know, management, even the social skills and relationship management. So the people are able to relate, you know, with that. Yeah. So, and I think it's a valuable contribution, because even when they sit for interviews, you've just mentioned your colleagues who are interning, you know, others would get other permanent positions. OB will be basically about understanding yourself, okay, individual differences, understanding attitudes, understanding values, you know. So all those, I think, are very, you know, perception issues. Yeah. So all those, I think, are very important.
That's very interesting. One thing about organizational behavior is, I know we're diving a little bit deep here, is sometimes it has so many points of view. It could be at any level of management. It could be top management, lower management. I know that when I was taking organizational behavior, I also had strategic management. And she is also your mentee, I guess. Oh, you guys know each other or something. But she's also like one of my favorite lecturers. we're not going to mention that name. But the relation of organizational behavior and strategic management when it comes to top level and how everything feeds into each other is something I noticed about my fourth year in university, was that everything we're doing was practical and it was just feeding into each other. So for you to get one course, you need to understand what you're doing in the other. So yeah, tell me like the relationship between the two, OB and strategic management. And you can also talk about your relationship with my other favorite lecturer.
Well, I think as lecturers, we sort of collaborate and coordinate because we are sort of drawing lessons, I think, from each other. And when we you've asked a very, very interesting question, like, for example, the relationship between OB and strategic management. Well, strategic management are sort of closely linked, or you can say intertwined, because OB does influence the strategies to be implemented. And obviously, strategic management involves setting goals, formulating plans. So obviously, when you're talking of management functions, we talk about planning, allocating resources. OB will focus on understanding and managing individual and group behavior. But you find also effective strategic management requires understanding of employee attitudes and motivation. So you find there'll be all these linkages, that motivation will link in with the Maslow's, the Hazelbridge, that communication, the agenda setting, the attribution theories, at decision making, at critical thinking, all those principles are quite key. And one thing about the undergrad courses is that the build up starts early. For example, you probably may remember, probably first year, there is introduction to management. Then probably along the way, there's business environment. So by the time now you're getting to organizational behavior and strategic management, you are now sort of aligning what you've learned into the practical phase. Because if you recall, most of these strategic management and OB are practical oriented. And I think during your class, you would remember we used to invite a lot of guest speakers. And fortunately, you've also now transitioned to become a guest speaker, I believe. So, which is, I think, also positive. Yeah, so by inviting guest speakers, for example, Ambassador, I think I recall you were there when Ambassador Chibamba Kanyama came. Eh? He had just been sworn in.
Yes, I was.
Yeah, and he came over to the class. And you can see because of the impact, even the whole of the dean had to be in attendance, you know, and I invited my other, even former alumni students to come and sit in. I think it was a good thing because what you get there is something practical, okay? Here's somebody from industry communicating, sharing to say, this is how it's done out there. So that you're now translating the theoretical aspects you are reading in the books, you can now relate. My colleague teaching strategic management, she's taken it to another level. She organizes field trips. You know, they'll go to the multi-facility economic zone. They'll go to companies like Trade Kings and Pepsi. And, you know, you actually sit down, speak to the CEOs, talk about strategy. And I thought that is also very, I think it's very innovative.
And, I don't know how I feel about her having the few trips when I'm done with university. I really have to reach out at this point.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think she's also a future candidate for the podcast. I mean, basically,
the
podcast would be incomplete without her.
I know. I have to reach out to her and say, hi, it's me again. Do you miss me? Do you want to do this with me? I'm reaching out to her.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it will be helpful because, and also we'll keep her name in as a surprise so that once she comes, people will just say, boom, bang. She'll give you a bit of her corporate experience as well because she's coming from industry at a very high level, executive level. And she's now transitioned into academia, which is also very good. I was just talking about you getting your mentor and your other lecturer on board, because then you can link industry with academia. And this is where I think the university ranks highly, because it's able to sort of bring together experts with different sets of knowledge, so that they can actually share and teach how actually it's done in industry.
And I think that's like one of my favorite things about UNILAS. They're able to bridge the gap, and it's really good to be an alumni for such a university, because we get access to really good, we really did get access and got access to really good lecturers and people that I asked myself, if I was at a different university, was this possible and would they care? Sometimes virtually let's say a little bit more privileged, and that's the part I'm diving into, because I've noticed that a lot of the students don't understand that element. They understand it afterwards and think, because I was at Tunilas and that man was my lecturer, he'll remember me. But if you did not learn how to create relationships earlier, it's going to be very hard for you to reach out for help from these people. So we've talked about organizational behavior. I'm more intrigued about students' behavior because you've been interacting with students for more than 10 years, if I'm not wrong. And I think you've seen the cycles of UNILAS also just growing as a university. How can you tell me about the student behavior at UNILAS in regard of the resources given to them compared to your olden days? I have to admit, I don't think you're in university in Zambia. So,
Yeah, no, yeah, most
if
of my studies I've studied abroad, yeah. But it's good to observe the kind of student behavior, and basically that we cover that under social psychology, because under social psychology we'll be looking at how society influences an individual's behavior. We talk about peer pressure, conformity, issues of persuasion. So you find that, one of the issues, actually, one of the students said it very well when we were talking about how students behave. This student just said, you see, it all depends, firstly, on how the parents raised them, okay? Because where the students come from. So most parents, if they are very busy, they tend to raise up pretenders because they don't have a relationship with their children. Okay? And this was coming from one of my students. Now, if parents don't allow students to open up on things that they like or not, in the process, the kids will just be doing things to please them. Eh? This is where you find you've got students, your children are leaving home. Okay, they will leave home very decently dressed. But in their handbags, they've actually taken additional clothes. They reach the mall, they change into those clothes, maybe which are a bit maybe revealing. And then the other thing about student behavior is what you call peer pressure. Sometimes they want to copy from their friends so as to fit in, forgetting about principles and values. So you find that even with OB, we normally emphasize the importance of ethical behavior. It's very, very important. Importance of values, because you find that at the end of the day, your ethical or moral compass might be the difference between how you respond in an interview, especially using the mirrors bigs under the Big Five. Are you going to be someone who's found to be agreeable? Are you conscientious? Or are you open to experience? So all those are personality types, which will depend on whether you can fit in or not. So that's what I've actually found. So it's actually different types. It's a mixture. Some come from home, some are in the boarding houses. Some in the boarding houses, I remember that group I taught the other year, they were excellent. Basically, you find even when they graduated, They had about three people who are outstanding students. You find someone is the best outstanding student in BBA, someone else in marketing, someone else in ECA. I mean, those were studying hard. And as I'm speaking now, they even got internships, and some of them have got jobs. So I thought we, as a university, we are very proud of them, that they did very well.
That's very interesting. It's something I've always talked about when I, because I've guest lectured in your classes twice now, and something I always like to emphasize and compare is, I hope as we go forward in the universities or institutions in Zambia, we could have personality tests for our students, so that in first year actually, so that everybody can start building on an awareness of who they are and how they fit in. Because like some are open-minded, some are not. Some are open to risk, some are not. Some are talkative, some are really reserved. So it's like, I like saying this. When you're in first year, they just throw you to the wolves. They just tell you, all you have to do is pass, right? When you're in university. But that's not it. Like, you don't have to be the best student. Again, I know you mentioned the best students and how that's important for university. But I'd like to mention that being an outstanding student doesn't mean you have to be the best student in class. I would say I was an outstanding student, but I wasn't the best student in class. So when we have tests like personality tests, everybody gets to know their strengths and their weaknesses, and they get to choose what they can work on best and what they can navigate. Because just because it's your weakness doesn't mean you have to not do it. You still have to do it. You still have to do the hard work. But then at least you're aware of it, and you know you probably have to put in more effort. So it's like very interesting. So when we have such people navigate from being students to organization and working for organization, how do you think they fit in? Let's talk about the ones that are extroverted and introverted. Like, how do they fit into an organization after coming to a place where you were just asked to pass? Now you're going into an organization where you're asked to implement and actually use initiative to get work done.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question that you've asked. Basically, fitting into an organization after graduation obviously involves a combination of factors. Okay? And obviously, from an organizational behavior perspective, it's obviously important for students, especially to understand culture, understand values, and understand norms that they are joining. Now, for example, at UNILAS, you've realized that normally we are very strict. We normally re-emphasize the dress code, for example. So you can't go into a new organization dressed as if you're going to a club. Okay? And then from a strategic management side of it, you see organizations need to effectively onboard. There's what you call onboarding, or what you call integrating new graduates into their workforce. Because at the end of the day, they're supposed to contribute to the achievement of strategic goals. Now, what does this involve? It may involve training. It may involve development. I'll give you an example. I stay in the IBEX area, and we have a community neighborhood group. So the IBEX area will be receiving, I think, a significant number of policemen and police women who have just recently graduated from the line. So the IBEX police station has requested the neighborhood that, look, those of you who've got extra accommodation, please can you assist us for about 2 months whilst these policemen are receiving orientation. So why have I given that example? Meaning that they are going to be first oriented. You know, how do you get to know your neighborhood? How do you get to understand what policing is involved? So they undergo orientation. So even students, don't just wait to intern or start a job after graduation. This actually should even begin, if possible, in second year. You should, during holidays, you need to sort of get an internship, organize an internship somewhere, It might be 2 weeks, might be 3 weeks. You learn one or two things. Some of these organizations might onboard you to be part of maybe their branding. One of my students, I remember I was his referee. He's now working for one of the banks. And I think he's doing very well. The other day, he sent me pictures. He was with the Bank of Zambia governor and the APSA MD at Mulunguchi. I think his bank were, then I said, wow, these are signs that, he's fitting into the environment. Yeah, so interning is, we normally encourage students, especially to transition maybe from a full-time, because when you are full-time, you have to be at uni from 8 to about 5. Eh? But usually, if you want to intern, it's better maybe you proceed either on part-time or distance. Especially, yes, most of the people do it in third year. Because what that is doing, it's also preparing you. You might intern at three places, depending on how you plan it. Maybe two places in third year, one place in fourth year. Then it's much easier. Your CV is now enriched. It's now much easier to now write to these employees, oh, now I've graduated. Please, if there's an opening, I'm available. And I think the transition then works out well.
I like that she talks about the transition because it's a conversation that we don't have a lot in university, even my university. No one really was talking about how it's important to transition from not giving school your all, but doing your best and also trying to factor in other stuff and getting more experience. And it also sometimes comes back from home. Like, to be honest, in our households, you're expected, majority of everybody is expected to just, if you're in school, do school. Get the good grades because that's what they are going to be putting value against. And I know you mentioned this part where kids pretend when they were with their parents and do other stuff. I totally relate. And when they're done with that, when they're done with university, because no one had conversations with them about transitioning and why transitioning is important, it's like you're thrown back to a war or to the wolves and you don't know what to do because they're like, okay, now you're done with university, get a job. But how do I get a job? So I get, what's your point of view on that?
Yeah, just to build on this experience, I think what I could mention is that, you see, going back to the issue of internships, they play a crucial role in bridging the gap between academia and industry. You see, because it's actually providing real world experiences. They are real insights. You know, I remember during our times in the early 80s, you've completed, before you even go to university, you actually used to get jobs even after grade 12 because you're waiting for your results. So you find that you are able to have practical application of knowledge. Okay, I remember I had to transition to one of the banks. So I went to the Copper Belt. I was sent to the Copper Belt, town of Luansha. So I was working in a bank. I can tell you that when I went for my first degree, did my master's, that experience was very valuable because you're always using case studies from that work experience to apply it now in your undergraduate and master. You can say, look, like when you go for interbank clearing, you are meeting different banks, you're exchanging after, all those issues. That's experience. How did you communicate? So you also learn skills. The goodness about internships and having this, then also exposure. You get exposed. I mean, do you even know how the inside of a bank looks like? Or I was with some young leaders at the development program in December 2 weeks ago, and one of them was sharing that she was at one of the public universities. She got an internship for 8 months at the United Nations. So you find it also helps to network. And she was networking on communication. So you can imagine right now, she's it has built her resume. You get resume building. She has learned from the challenges. Because you see, then you begin to appreciate when a lecturer says it's 10 hours, anyone who comes 10 minutes late, please go to the library. Then you understand the importance of time management. Because you see, at uni, there are people who even think they can walk into class 40 minutes late, you know, just say, ah, it's okay, I'll go. But you see, the teaching starts from there, you know, so that, because once we teach you from uni to say, look, this is what industry expects, you might actually even lose out on a confirmation at an organization because they'll look at you and say, look, I don't think you are someone who's taking work seriously. So probably we need to part company. Yeah. So I think that's what I could say. So to touch on those issues, it's very important to have practical application of knowledge. It's important for skills development because, you know, you have to enhance a wide range of skills. Some of this could be presentation skills, writing skills, communication skills, problem-solving skills. Then the exposure also helps because it gives you a better understanding of the trends in industry, the practices, the culture. And also, you know, through an internship, you can actually know that, look, is this what I would want to pursue as a career decision? Let's say if I'm to pursue a master's, should I pursue a master's in this field? You know, sometimes you've got a BBA, you've got an ECA. Now you want to sort of make a decision on what area should you specialize on. Networking, you know, you build relationships with industry professionals. You know, it could be with Institute of Directors, it could be with Zika, Zambia Institute of Accounts, or it could be with the Zambia Institute of Human Resources, depending on which area. Yeah, so all that, I think that's positivity. I think it all builds into the equation.
I love that you are emphasizing on why skills development is important. I could also mention skill stacking. Having a better understanding of what skills you want to build. It also comes from a place of, do you know where you want to go? We have these conversations at the time, of course, but people like going with the flow, especially students, and hoping things will be figured out for them. Or the path would be clear, but that's not how life works. And like internship is important, but if you can't find, because a lot of people say, no, internships are so hard to find, you need connections. Could be true. I really can't deny or accept anything of that. But you could always do something, learn a new skill. You could always volunteer. There's so many organizations that want volunteers. And you could just meet different people through, there's so many different channels in Zambia that you can actually do that. And one of my favorite things is, so when you're in class, you'd always talk about your experience and working with different regimes and presidents. And one day you even wore your army uniform. I'll try to think if you're in the army, but anyway, so you wear your army uniform, you talk about how you are that person, but not that person, and we should all know it. So yes, how was your experience with working in, because you have experience working in the public and private sector, so public and private, so how does that feel to work with different regimes and actually see democracy in Zambia evolve in a long period of time?
Okay. Zambia in this year, 2024, will be commemorating 60 years of independence. And since 1964, we've had 7 presidents. And I remember the first time I met the first president, I think I was 9 years old. I come from a family, obviously, where my father used to be a politician. So he was actually in government. So during some function, they will receive invitations to attend. You know, May 1 is called, May 25th is called the investiture ceremony. It's Africa Freedom Day. Yeah. So they usually invite senior government officials. So I remember we went with my young siblings, brothers, I think, yeah. And then that's the first time I met the president. So in short, I've met all the 7 presidents, and I've worked basically with some, at least maybe five directly. The other two, I continue to support from behind the scenes, you know, in terms of the work I do in terms of Institute of Directors and Governance. We are supporting government policy development, government capacity building. Yeah, so I think it's been very interesting seeing the transition. You know, I remember when I just came back from abroad after my first degree, and I joined the Ministry of Commerce. That was under President Kaunda. That was in 1990. And I think within a year, new government took over. So there was a lot of things that changed. You know, you've got a new government. It's looking at young people. It's saying, look, we don't want to do with the old style of, you know, this is a market economy. So you find already you're 25, 26, well, with a colleague of mine who's now a very, very senior person in the central bank, is now, I think, deputy governor. So we were the two of us. We joined in 1990. After a year, the ministers in the new government just loved us. So we were sprung from basically being economists. You become almost like assistant directors. You become minister's assistants, always accompanying the minister, whether it's on regional meetings. So like my colleague would accompany my minister to go and deliver letters from President Chiluba, inviting them for COMESA meetings. So you can imagine you go to meet President Museveni, you go to meet President, you know, in Angola, you go, you know. And then I was on the other part, I was dealing with privatization and the World Bank. Yeah, so that was also, it gave me a lot of experience, exposure, you know. That was my exposure, okay, at my level where I was traveling a lot around Africa, around Europe, the US, because my core functionality was privatization. So we had to be trained. I think we had support programs from the United States. So we went to the US, we went to Germany to learn how the Germans handled privatization from eastern part of Germany. Yeah, we used to attend the Paris Club meetings with the current Minister of Finance. He was, I think, then just the director at the Central Bank, you know. So all those were the delegations, you know. It was very interesting. I'm just trying to, you know, I'll try and when I write a book, I think one of my hobbies was taking videos and pictures. So I just need to transcribe some of those videos when we used to move with most of these senior advisors, the Bank of Zambia governor, the ministers of finance. I remember even then the acting president was Minister of Agriculture, Guy Scott, you know. So we'll be sitting there in Paris with the ambassador briefing us. Okay, this is how, you know. So it's I think it's been very interesting. And the various positions, I've not only served as an economist, I've also served as a media person. See, I've ended up transitioning as Permanent Secretary, Ministry of Information, Permanent Secretary, Cabinet Office in charge of strategy. So the strategy you're talking about, I could actually apply it. And then one of the disciplines in OB is political science. I hope you remember that one. Yeah. And I ended up as Special Assistant at State House for Policy.
I don't remember it. But yeah.
Yeah. So policy and politics. Yeah. So I think that's it's been quite a journey. And also there was a time under the late President Mwanawasa when he issued the Gazette notice. I mean, these are public documents where all permanent secretaries were given powers to perform functions of ministers. So we're even having cabinet meetings. Okay, yeah, so that's also, I think, it's a very, very important phase, you know, where the ministers were all, parliament is dissolved, there are no ministers. So the only people who have to perform ministerial functions are now the PSs. So we became, quote unquote, ministers for about 3 months. Yeah, so it's been quite a journey to transition. That was the public sector. But then there's also the other story, working with other presidents whilst now in the private sector. This is where now you tend to see the world from the other side, you know, in terms of how do you engage, how do you relate, what's the interface? Yeah, so that also has brought in a lot of experience. I've been involved in a lot of consulting with international organizations. We've had some publications, some research collaborations. And now I'm a fellow with a number of not only local, also international institutions. I'm also on the expert groups of, I think, one corporate governance institute in Asia. In Zambia, I'm part of the Institute of Directors. So I think it's been quite a journey. It's given us a lot of experience because now you've got different organizations calling upon us to try and address some of their challenges, you know, to sort of assist them to innovate their thinking of their management stuff. Yeah. So this is where you find that from 2011 to date, so I've been involved in facilitating maybe over 100 corporate board inductions, leadership training. And of late, I've enjoyed it, especially with the universities. I think the public universities, the government has come up with a policy pronouncement that governance should underpin the way universities are run. So we've been having a very close relationship, I think, with the Ministry of Education in terms of delivering these pro-corporate governance training and team building initiatives with the public universities. So I think it's gone on very well.
I'd like to take you back to the 90s because I am curious and I wasn't in existence at that point. During the privatization, you don't have to go in details, but I'd like to know what are the lessons you learned during that period, especially that you went from working in Kaunda's regime to go to Chiluva's. Like, what are some of the lessons and things you'd like to tell people on how to set up yourself? You know, because mostly some of the myths, it's not even a myth, sorry, but some of the stuff is when the old government calls, the new government comes, a lot of people get laid off or fired. So I'm just interested in how you set yourself up. I know you just joined a year before and change of government, but I would also just just a sneak peek in like some of your tips of how the country was running at that point when most of the government institutions were being privatized.
You see, one of the interesting aspects of policy, you know, usually economic development, I think, thrives on policy and reform. There's usually a reform agenda, and usually a reform agenda seeks to improve on the past. Okay? So when we had the Kaunda government, there was what was called the Technical Committee on Privatization. So this actually, privatization initiatives began under Kaunda. Not really the MMT that began. There was a technical committee. But you see, that work was just accelerated when now the new government came in. They said, okay, fine, we've got a technical committee. Is there legislation? No. Can we draft legislation? So we drafted legislation now, which took effect, I think, in May 1992. We had the Privatization Act. We created an organization called the Zambia Privatization Agency. So there was institutional reform. Now, when you are reforming, you need capacity. So this is where you are saying in the 90s, what happened? One, there has to be clear objectives. Number two, any reform program should have transparency. Okay, and then secondly, you talked about people being laid off. Well, it's very important to have a social impact mitigation. So fortunately, there was a project, because I was with the Ministry of Commerce, and so I left the Ministry of Commerce after 4 years, because the United Nations, through UNDP, said they want to support the social impact of privatization, meaning that how do you build capacity, train those into alternative livelihoods? Okay? So we created a program called the National Social Safety Net. And that was the first project manager. And that's the first time I started receiving dollars as a salary, because I drafted the project document. I think it was that time, it was about $1 million. And we ran with that, I think, for about I think 6 years. That's before I left for my master's to go to Japan. When I came back, we again started commercializing Zambia Railways. So the World Bank again gave us another $2 million. I was still the project manager. So we also ran with that. Yeah. So understanding the regulatory framework, you know. So the new government wanted to do things differently. And the lessons we can learn from privatization is that the policies are made by government, and government will decide which sectors they will maintain. If they say, look, Zambia Railways will still remain state, they've decided. The mines, they decide it will be sold. And if they decide, they'll make a decision, say, look, we're not selling to Akakendelwa. We are going to break down the mine. So we'll sell to Akakendelwa, then we'll sell to somebody else. So that's how you see now that the mines, you find Mufulira is different from Kitwe, from Tingola, different buyers. Okay. But that's only one thing. When you look at Niek stores, Mwaiseni, okay. If you go now to social media, these used to be the major retail shops. Most of these, I think that's where now ShopRite has acquired Pick n Pay and these other retail shops. So Milimil Bread used to there used to be a super baking company. But we said, is it the job of government to be making bread? No. Let the private sector. So I think the question also is for research purposes, since we're in academia, is that we need to draw lessons from what Stiglitz. You see, Stiglitz was an economist from the World Bank, and he was trying to look at the Washington consensus. What were the advantages and disadvantages? So, what are the things? So, he was looking at the global perspective. Did the privatization, not only in Africa, but did privatization benefit, okay, through those 10 points? Okay, so Zambia could just be looked at within the lens of the consensus. Okay, did we look at the real economy, for example, economic growth? Did we look at employment? Did we look at land reform? So those are the things but we tended to be so fixated, I think, on inflation rate, whether inflation is this, but really, were we looking at the real? This is what Stiglitz was saying. Were we looking at the real, you know, the real economy, so that the conditionalities are not in place? So that's what I could say basically about. So it's not only the privatization program I was involved in, Accra. Later, I was now involved in other major programs along the way before I left the government. Some of them, like just restructuring of these entities such as Indico and ZIMCO, because we had to abolish those. We said, look, it's duplicating with ZPA. Because if you're going to privatize, you have to decrease the public sector. So remember, it was so interesting. There are times where you are attending a meeting where you'll be dissolving an institution where your future secretary to the cabinet will be coming from. You know, I remember one of the secretary to the cabinet was at ZIMCO, and we were attending a meeting where we were saying, now, yes, you should be winding up. Citizens' Economic Empowerment, that was also another exciting program under President Mwanawasa. We got involved, and it has benefited a number of institutions because we are hearing of banks going under. It's because there was no state-supported finance. But when the state has a vehicle, you know, the rates will be concessionary. I think a number of institutions have benefited. So that's what I could say. A number of National Social Security Reform Program. I was also involved as a team transitioning from National Provident Fund to NAPSA. So all these, there's a lot that was involved, you know, bringing in the PIA, you know, putting in legislation. Yeah, so there are so many. So those were very interesting experiences.
I'd like to mention that I'm just realizing you really do have the more than 30 years experience I read about, because just playing it out here, because of just the depth of how the conversation is going and the fact that we've mentioned like a number of banks going under. Don't know why. There might be a lot of reasons apart from liquidity that we're not aware of right now. And it just gives me back to corporate governance. You're part of a number of boards. You also now train board members. You started with public sector, went into the private sector. Now I know you do mostly is training. So public sector, privatization, that was the Kaunda, Chiluva era. Then the Mwanawasa era, worked on different projects. And now I do not know what you did in ECL. What I currently know is you do a lot of trainings, like you mentioned earlier, which has to do with like government institutions, government universities. So you have this wealth of knowledge in corporate governance and strategic leadership. How are you navigating that now?
Okay. Yeah, you were asking what we did under the PF. My last position in government was at State House in 2011. So after 2011, there was a new government, the PF, under the SATA, ECL, now there is HH. Yeah, so as a member of Institute of Directors, we collaborate with the government. And we are partners. So they do invite us to conduct trainings and capacity building. So that is the input. That's what I could say. I remember as a consultant under the UNDP, we developed the input into the national youth policy. We conducted a study on youth unemployment with a colleague I worked with at State House, the late Francis Chigunda. So that, we even saw the National Youth Policy being launched. I think that was in 2014, 2015. Yeah, so with corporate governance, it's not only the public sector. I'm now in the private sector. So we are working with the private sector in terms of ensuring that their boards are equipped with the basic corporate governance training. Right now, I'm also on the faculty of the Zambia Institute of Insurance and Pensions, that is collaborating with PIA. We've come up with a curriculum to train all trustees on pension boards. They're even being examined. And it's very interesting. Some of these trustees are my former students. You know, some of them are under different organizations. Again, we are meeting there. And then corporate governance also helps in fostering the professional development, CPDs, because continuous education is essential for staying abreast in terms of developments in corporate governance. Right now, there are certain concepts. I think you are familiar with ECG. Okay. What is ECG? This is a new concept that we're also incorporating now in corporate governance. ECG stands for environmental social governance, which is a criteria used to evaluate a company's performance and practices in three areas. Environmental, how are they dealing with a carbon input, social areas, how a company manages relationships with shareholders, employees, communities, customers. Governance refers to the systems, processes that guide decision making. But another interesting area which we are going into, which is very, very interesting for corporate governance, is the issue of artificial intelligence. Because you see, with artificial intelligence and decision making, boards now need to be aware that some decisions can actually now be made much faster. It will revolutionize governance decision making because it will enhance efficiency, accuracy, and effectiveness. Because you see, if governance is about processes, rules, and procedures, now imagine you are a bank, your a pension scheme, you want to invest money. With artificial intelligence, it will actually tell you, look, if you invest in this stock, these are the returns in 10 years. If you invest now, that information in the past, we used to get that from investment manager. But now with artificial intelligence, you are talking about data analysis, you're talking about predictive analytics, policy modulation, personalized governance services, risk management, policy recommendation, even issues of ethics. So you find that just like we talk about internship, the same also with these institutions. The central bank has got the Banking and Financial Services Act. Banks are required to undergo corporate governance training every year. They have, because you then have to be to sort of come to terms with what are the new trends now in banking, what are the new trends in agriculture, what are the new trends in commerce, in marketing. So it's actually a broad field, So when you have a presentation before you, you're just not sticking just to corporate governance. Sometimes it will be, what is the Companies Act saying? What is the Securities and Exchange Act saying? What is the Banking and Finance Act? So there's a legislative aspect as well. But issues, as I've mentioned, ECG, we remember training some senior management at one of the mines on the copper belt. This was very seen as a very, very key issue because the mines are involved in, extracting the mineral. So what are the environmental issues? So ECG was very important. And then artificial intelligence, you talk to IT, ICT companies, very, very important because even I remember one university that is dealing with healthcare. How are you going to use artificial intelligence? Let's say when there's another epidemic, you use now robots are the ones moving from ward to ward because you are minimizing infection. Yeah. So that's how broad I could mention the navigation.
That's so interesting. I'd like to take you back. What's corporate governance?
Well, corporate governance is it's basically a process by which companies are managed or directed. Now, you've got shareholders, and so shareholders will normally identify independent directors who will sort of manage and or provide oversight. Okay, so it's a system of rules, practices, and processes through which organizations. Now, the goodness about corporate governance, it's not only businesses. You can also refer to corporate governance in a hospital, corporate governance in a university, corporate governance in a sports organization. So you're trying to encompass the relationship between different stakeholders. On one hand, you've got the shareholders, the board members, the executives, customers, suppliers, and communities. Yeah. So the key aspects of corporate governance, there has to be a board of directors, there has to be shareholder rights, there has to be transparency and disclosure, obviously, ethical conduct. So this is why I find under corporate governance, we would usually encourage, the formulation of a board charter, so that you address all these issues. But overall, corporate governance will deal with issues such as stakeholder engagement, ethical conduct and integrity, and basically regulatory compliance.
I'd like to admit this is the most academical we've had a conversation together.
Oh, are you sure?
Apart from your classes, I'm just like, whoever's going to listen to this podcast, this episode, is going to learn a lot on
Yeah,
different
not.
areas.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
I would just like, because you train directors in different sectors, like you mentioned, public, private, and there's, I wouldn't say it's a trend, it's because it's a good thing. There's this thing I'm seeing around where a lot of trainings are available to young people for them to be trained as board members. Because yeah, like building capacity so that these other trainings we have for board members. And I'm like, what do you see the future for Zambia in corporate governance, like the next 10 years?
Okay, yeah. No, I think that's a very interesting question because when we talk about training the future directors, what are our expectations? No, definitely training directors, managers, future directors is essential because it promotes, skills development. And these initiatives can assist in enhancing decision making. And overall, how just to mitigate risks? You see, most of these organizations, there is an issue of managing risks, different type of risks. That's also another podcast on its own, discussing the different types of risk, but also to improve overall performance. So you find that in terms of the future, the next 10 years, these are, I think, the key areas that we need to focus on, okay? I think these areas, there are about six areas, okay? I'll just mention them in 10 seconds. Increased emphasis on ECG. We talked about ECG, environmental, social governance. Secondly, digital transformation. How are we going to adopt digital technology? I've talked about AI. Customized training solutions. You see, it's not one size fits all. I think if you're dealing with ZRA, you're dealing with Bank of Zambia, you're dealing with the US Embassy, you're dealing with, FRA, UNILAS, it has to be customized. What actually fits a university, what fits a bank, what fits a regulatory institution? Then also the issue of board diversity. Because board diversity means you're going to be very inclusive. You're talking about composition in terms of the differently abled, gender diversity, skill diversity. You cannot have a board of directors full of accountants. Board of directors just full of lawyers. You need to do that. And then also the need to focus on ethics and integrity, and then also regulatory compliance, stakeholder engagement, all these. So in basically, the future of corporate governance is, it will be continuous learning on those areas, investing in training initiatives, strengthening governance practices, building trust, and creating long-term value for stakeholders as the Zambian business landscape evolves. Since we know that Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos have got a mind, so obviously we see a lot of, JP Morgan coming in, Boston Consulting coming, so they'll bring in the whole Silicon Valley. That's what I could say.
That's interesting. When you look back to your childhood and the person you are now, what do you think influenced the decisions you've made all your life? Like from your childhood, like what's that element you think influenced you to probably end up? It could be a different series of activities, but when you look back, like what's that one thing you say, this probably influenced me to end up as the person I am right now?
Well, I did my secondary school at Munali. And whilst at Munali, we had different, we had the pure sciences, we had, those who were in the commerce group, yeah, and then there was the middle group, yeah. So I was in the commerce group. So by pursuing commerce, before that I'd done metalwork and technical drawings. Obviously, I couldn't become an architect or an engineer, but I did more of commerce. So basically my path was sort of determined to be one of pursuing business. I was always going to be a business, in the business cluster. Yeah, so by the time I was finishing grade 12, I told you about interning at a bank. So when I went for my first degree, obviously I pursued economics. And that's what landed me in the Ministry of Commerce. But after that, the economics now was practical because now you're working in an economic ministry, You're dealing, I didn't even go into details. Apart from privatization, they rotated us in commerce. Eh? We're not always in the planning department. Sometimes you've been trade, sometimes you've been industry department. You know? So, but it was when I went for my master's, and it's very interesting how I even got that. It's a World Bank scholarship. It was basically in an Economist magazine along the post office. Someone was selling it on the ground, you know, and said, yeah, I like this. So I picked it up and checked an advert that they are looking for 10 graduates, developing countries, for a program in Japan. Okay, and it's a master's in philosophy in policy management, okay, international development and policy management. And it only had 3 days deadline to go. It was actually, that time I think we had, did we have internet? That time I was using more of fax machines. But I was able to send in my application. I think I faxed it somehow. It reached everything, including qualifications. I remember getting my mentor to sign a recommendation. Yeah, so there I learned in Japan. Basically, I learned international development and policy management. So when now I came back, it now became easier. I mentioned apart before I left, I did privatize. When I came back, I started working on social safety nets, the UNDP, social protection policies, then now went into citizens' economy. So basically, I've been involved in reform. Okay. That's how I ended up now as PS Labor, changing the employment and labor landscape, you know, coming up with labor laws, you know, what would apply here. So I think it's the career, as you are going through, there are certain things that will interest you. Yeah. So then you can actually tweak your research interests. For example, if I had ended up at Ministry of Communication or Ministry of Energy, maybe I could have done a master's in petroleum management. So but because I was in the Ministry of Commerce and, handling these other policy issues, so that program in Japan came in very handy. And usually, you see, there's this debate about master's versus PhD. And it has worked very well, especially for the students I've been teaching that have actually acquired postgraduate. But I would always recommend postgraduate PhD is a researcher. As much, we don't just get a PhD for purposes of being called doctor. I think it's important to practice. You need to bring new knowledge. You need to research. You know, you need to use your mind, you know. Yeah, so that is what we are now doing at UNILAS. We are not just teaching. I think we are also publishing. So I'm also an author. I write op-eds for the Zambia Daily Mail. These are sort of research opinions besides the editorial opinion. By virtue of having been PS information, so I have that privilege, I have access there. So, yeah. So, and then I'm also publishing a book on the fundamental principles of corporate governance in Zambia. So, it should be able to come out before the end of the year.
I can't wait for your book. I can't wait to be at the launch, get a book, you sign it, and we're going to talk about
okay.
it. Okay. I'm going to have an element of talking about books because I'm a book lover. What I took from mostly what I took from that is maybe that scholarship I need is probably lying on the street somewhere in a newspaper or a magazine. So I should put down my phone. That's what I took from that. And to close up, what do you look forward to going forward?
Well, I think you see. I'm a person who believes in diversification. I would always advise students, never put all your eggs in one basket. Always, just like investors, investors don't invest only in one stock, you know. So there is need to develop, learn about new skills, okay? So that, I think, is very important, yeah? Because you may have a BBA degree, you may have a Bachelor of Accounting, or you have ACCA, but is there a skill that you might need that you think can help you to navigate certain areas. You know, I know colleagues from Copperbelt University who studied land economy. Now, they've diversified. They've actually gone back to school and acquired a law degree. So now what has happened is they are combining real estate management with the legal expertise. Okay. So you can learn new skills. So I'll give an example of myself. I'm working with colleagues in the diaspora. So I'm now into property management. You know, that's not something I learned in Japan, but this is a skill that now I've shown interest in because of the strategic pathways. So because of that skill, you know, that has now provided another revenue stream. Because now, on behalf of the diaspora, you're able to manage their properties, you're able to construct properties, you know, then you find that the other area as well, where I'm also very entrenched, is the issue of corporate governance, is that I also sit on boards, meaning that I'm also available to serve on various boards, you know. So I've moved, it's not only academia, but I'm into board membership, but I'm also into corporate governance training as well and management training. Then I'm also into property management. Okay. Yeah, so there are quite so many things. And also, because having been in the media, I'm also interested in the media. So I also do media. Yeah, so that is, you know, as I say, writing articles and consultancy as well. That's also another area which keeps me busy, you know. So, and also just like Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, you should be available for speaking engagements because there'll be a number of institutions, some are faith-based, some are business, they'll be calling you. And there's a price to that, you know. One of my students, I'm very impressed, his name is Dumisani Ngube. I hope one day he comes on your podcast. He's a real example of somebody he's made it in life. He was my master's student at UNILAS. He graduated, and I think he gave the speech on behalf of all the other students. Yeah, so you need to be quite broad. Don't just put your eggs into one basket. So that's what my advice would be. So that if one area is not working, the other areas will sustain you. And apart from that, invest. I've invested in a number of business ventures, which are bringing income. So that's also another diversification. So you find that you just don't stick to one thing. You need to be broad-based.
I have learned so much from this conversation. And my key takeaway is diversification and learning how to transition from one thing to the next and being open-minded. I never knew this open-minded, but your story does show how you have been open-minded and accepted, changed, and moved on. And that's like my main lesson. The other thing is I'm definitely going to hit you up for those numbers that I need for my next guest list. So please text me back. But okay. As always, thank you so much for making the time to be here. Thank you for always picking up the call or text and making time for just... Because I know like time is like very important here to you as well. You're a very busy man. So thank you so much for just creating the space and having this conversation with me. Yeah, I look forward to more conversations with you.
Excellent. No, thank you very much, Aka, for this opportunity to appear on your podcast. And I look forward to receiving the link so that I could share this with my class as well, so that we'll have more subscribing to your podcast.
Yes. Thank you so much. With that being said, that's the end of the episode, today's episode. Please share and subscribe, follow, tell a friend, tell somebody. And yeah, see you next Tuesday.